best Cork sporting action at the weekend.
One goal to win the title. It's as simple as that.
Can you believe this?
Have you ever seen a try like that?
The Big Red Bench
on Cork
Red FM.
Hello and good evening. You are listening to the Big Red Bench with myself, Orla O'Leary. And we're all devastated. Cork losing by 1 point to Limerick in the Munster Hurling Championship final. But we can be sure they are going to be back. And we could put all our prayers on the All-Ireland, the real one, the real title that matters the most. Limerick, they're used, you see, to getting their Munster final championship win and their All-Ireland win. That's how they usually do it, but I think we're going to crush their dreams now this year, and we're going to get back at them for their 1 point victory, which was just so cruel. But we will now face Offaly in the quarter final for the All-Ireland on the 20th or the 21st of June, not quite confirmed yet, which is a throwback to 2024 where we played them in the quarter final of the All-Ireland and we won by 6 points. And we also faced them twice this season in the league, where away we won by 3 points and at home in the park we won by 24 points. So to be fair, we do have a good chance of getting past this little blimp and then heading off into the All-Ireland and getting it done, getting our title. But there was loads more GAA happening around the country today. So in the All-Ireland Ladies Football Championship, Mayo took on Dublin at 1 p.m. and they won. It was Dublin 3 goals, 12 points, Mayo 12. And then at 2 p.m, Kerry faced Tipperary and Meath faced Galway, with Kerry and Galway winning at full time in their respective games. And we also had the Camogie Championship today. Waterford faced Tipperary and Waterford beat Tip by 3 points. And our girls, they also got a great start to their All-Ireland campaign yesterday, where they won as well. So there's something to cheer about this weekend, and I'm sure there will be something to cheer about in 2 weekends to come. And then there was F1 today. We had the Monaco Grand Prix with 5 wins in a row for Antonelli, but unfortunately Charles Leclerc, he crashed out towards the end, and he was actually doing very well. He was placing third for majority of the competition right up until the end. But unfortunately, it wasn't his day. And Max Verstappen and Lando Norris were among those who also didn't finish. Max Verstappen, very surprising. I am a Max Verstappen fan. Wasn't very happy. But sure, look, there's plenty more Grand Prix. But we're going to rewind now to Cork versus Limerick. So we now have Ben O'Connor speaking to the media after today's narrow defeat to Limerick.
Controlling at home. Tough defeat to take, 1 point in the end. What's the feeling a couple of minutes after that?
Yeah, disappointed. Tough conditions out there, but our boys battled hard. But yeah, disappointed after it. Thought a few decisions went against us. We were punished heavily for them. Small margins at this level, so, yeah.
Yeah, small margins. What do you think went against you in particular?
What do you think went against us?
I'm not sure. There's a lot of whistles being blown throughout the game on both sides.
I thought it was a very stop-start. Thought of a lot of frees. Did we commit twice as many frees as the opposition? I have to watch back on television, but you saw it there live, that you had to stand above. Did we commit twice as many frees? I'm Corkman, so I'm saying we didn't. So you're the neutrals, so you have to make up your mind on that.
There was a lot of disappointment, obviously, at the end. The players surrounded the referee. What's your read on that with the last play of the game? Because there was a couple of times when
Tim O'Mahony
was down on the ground before that final
three. Yeah, I met some of the boys there, and they just said, they said to him, go off the field, that he didn't tell them until the last puck of the ball. So, I thought normally a referee just said, this is lads, should go with the director, but they said he didn't. So, now the boys, when you assess around them, that's a little bit much now. They were walking alongside him. He his team of officials alongside him, shorts, they were walking alongside him. There was no one raised their voice to just say, why didn't you tell us? That was the only issue the boys had.
Maybe going for the third pass, Ben, back into Tim O'Mahony. You know, maybe Coleman had that spit chance, you know, after going short of it.
Yeah, against Breeze, big Breeze. So, yeah. But if you were told, Joe, you know, maybe the third pass wouldn't be there, then you'd know on your head, like, so.
Yeah. I spoke with William O'Donoghue outside, and he said he was told that was the last shot.
Which is great that he was told, but we weren't told when we got the free to Brilliant that they told him. Fair play to whoever told him.
Right. Right. And that wind was a bigger, like, it was hard to judge how strong it was, but I suppose when Collins didn't go for the remark, it was obviously, you know, it was slightly out of range.
Yeah, it's a big breeze out there. Yeah, and we probably weren't up enough at halftime. I suppose we were up 6 points and we gave away a few, well, we didn't give away a few frees. There was a few frees given against us just before halftime. Brought them back into the game, so we were only two up at halftime, so we knew it was going to be a battle. But as I said, the lighting with our lads, 77 minutes and still only puck for ball between us.
Yeah, you led for nearly the whole game. It was just at the very end. You know, Brody Hegarty went in full forward and it caused a few problems in there.
Yeah, sure, big strong man, good hurler, always going to cause problems.
But just final one for me, Ben, what's it like in a game like that where Owens has the hand up in the air nearly the whole time, and you know, do players kind of think on their feet and just take their man on knowing that they're going to get free?
I think that's the way fellas look. They see this freeze begin, so they just put the head down. As I said to you before, Cullum, it's the fastest field game in the world. And it's a split second. We had the Bowden Linzer fight last night. Fellas looking for a fella to be sent off. Dublin cornerback to be sent off for what? Put his hands out like that. As soon as he got a contact and left his early goal, he knew that he was high. Fellas looking for a right card for that. So, look. I just think that there was a few of them decisions were hard against us, and I'm not taking away from Limerick's win either, not taking away from that, but I just think there was a few. So
Ben, you don't think he took into consideration the greasy conditions?
No, fell asleep slightly on all of us, do you know, but no, I suppose it was back more to refereeing like in the league. That's the life we've got to hear now, and with championship refereeing matches, whereas I thought that was a little bit more like league order.
Plenty of talk even before the ball was thrown in that the two you might meet again and might be an All-Ireland final. So how did you divorce yourself from that kind of talk in terms of regrouping for the All-Ireland series?
We set out our sods after the year to win the league. We didn't. We set out our sod in after that to win the Munster Championship. We didn't. Now we're starting the competition. We've offed in 2 weeks time. That's the only one that's going to happen. Our video lads will be on tomorrow doing the analysis. Then it was great the GA couldn't tell us either that the fixture is on where it's on in 2 weeks time. Then over the last couple of weeks it was either Cork or Limerick against Offaly, so we'd have liked to know that as well a bit earlier, but sure, we'll get another drive on after that.
Do you get a sense of going back? Would you be happy, you know, have
any preference? Anywhere at all. We've 2 weeks time, we've 2 weeks to get ready for it. New competitions after it. So anywhere they want to play us in the country, we'll be ready.
Ben, you were touching on it there. 5 minutes to go at half time, 6 up. At half time, 2 up. How much did that influence your half time team chat?
We actually didn't talk about it. We didn't put this on point. That was done and dusted. That was that 35 minutes out of the way as well. But what we did talk about, it was 2 minutes of injury time in the first half, and it was 5 minutes at the end of the second half. So I don't know how, to me, I thought it was kind of the same for both halves, but with 5 minutes at the end of the second half as well. Like, so look, we go home, we watch it a couple of times, and we'll pick up a little bit more out of it. It's hard when you're on the sideline there, and things are helter skelter. You don't see everything that's going on.
You had loads of positives taken as well.
Yeah, we've loads of positives as well. Yeah, great bunch of lads, and we'll drive on again. As I said, now we've off in 2 weeks. I'm not ill, so never mind.
How close is it's given? It's obviously in the standby panel, not good enough to start.
Another couple of weeks. We wouldn't risk anyone. He was on that. Dickie got picked up an injury last week. Dickie was on it last week, so Dickie was out of it this week for that. So it's the only reason.
Ben,
don't say
that. Refereeing influence your decisions on the line? Like, for example, might be more likely to get a second yellow.
Well, he had a card, yeah. So like at that stage, when you see the freeze that we're giving him, fellas looking inside, I suppose to say it at that stage. So you have to look at that as well. Like, yeah, it's hard that you have to be looking at that a fella who's playing well, you have to take him off, you know, just because he had a card. Soft yellow card as well. But sure, look, that's just the way it is.
Ben, there was a couple of frees down at the corner of the city end. You might have them in mind midway through the second half. Jeremy Burns, and one was moved up from 30 metres. Is that what you're specifically talking about, or generally?
No, in general. I thought we should have got a few more frees. Whatever about their frees, I thought we should have got more few frees. The couple there in front of us, ball dropping from a puck out, and Brian Hayes being pulled backwards. William Buckley was turned upside down inside. So is it because we're not making enough noise over it, or we're not throwing the hands up there and throwing a few shapes? I don't know. But we might learn. We might learn it.
It's interesting you say that, Ben. I saw you having words with Kyle. He does a lot of remonstrating with the sport official.
I suppose he said during the week that he had fierce respect for referees, and I suppose he does, and that he, we should all leave him alone. But he spent a lot of time having a word with him. I suppose if you can get away with it, you can get away with it.
You marked him that over, did you?
We were just seeing what he was doing after the match and what I was doing after the match. We're just having a quick chat. You know yourself now, to, when things get a small bit easier.
Ben, does this one sting, aside from the refereeing and not being happy with it, does it sting because of the fact that coming down the straight you didn't get as many scores as you normally would in the matches that you played?
I suppose conditions were hard, and like all our games we've played so far, and that's for both teams, we've played in ball hoppy on the ground and travelling, whereas it was blustery and a bit damp out there today. So that, I suppose, that, and against the breeze in as well, I suppose we have to try and work the ball a little bit closer. There's no point shooting from 60-70 yards, so we have to work a little bit closer, and I suppose they got a few knockdowns with a few chances and just didn't take them.
And just a couple of words on Brian's goal. We've seen Brian Corcoran score off his knees. We've seen Patrick Corcoran score off his knees. We've never seen a fellow score off his backside. Great goal.
Yeah, he's a great finisher. Brian's a great finisher. Hopefully there's a few more to come out before the year is out.
Just on the reffing again, were you surprised he took that tack given he reffed it very differently earlier in the championship? Is that your sense?
I thought he'd done a great job the first day, but we won the first day, so maybe that's why he came out. You know, so that's a different story altogether. But I just thought today that it was very whistle happy. You can't be criticising these fellas. They're not getting paid, they're inside, there's fierce pressure on them, as I said, split second decision. But I'm looking through red eyes, and I thought that we were actually treated with
fair. Ben,
sorry,
just to clarify on the very last play, and you said they weren't told it was the last. Did they get any communication? Mark or Patrick was around the ball. He said it was 30 seconds left for 20. No,
I don't know. I was told, one of the lads said to me coming off the field, he never said, and that's what they were saying to him, you never told us it was last spoken about. Now, I'm only third hand information getting off of the lads. That's what they said to me coming off. I was talking to them coming out, they said that they weren't told anything.
Had you communicated in whether to go short or go out, or was that kind of left up to the players?
Sure, up to the players. You were 80 yards from goals in August. Gale wind against us, so there was no option to go along. We had to find someone. That's the way we play. Look, we're disappointed, but as I said, that's the Munster campaign out of the way now, and we've an All Ireland series to get going. It's three competitions, and we've none of the two competitions won yet. So we'll start off now in 2 weeks' time.
And no doubt about it, they will do it in 2 weeks' time, and we will get their commiserations to the Cork squad today. But he will be back, and we are very much looking forward to the All-Ireland campaign. But moving on now, earlier today, I spoke to Adam Sweeney, who is from Waterford, and he is the youngest Irish person to summit Mount Everest at the age of just 22. Adam only finished his climb in recent weeks, in which he was training very hard for. Here on the Big Red Bench, we are joined with Adam Sweeney. He is only 22 and he is the youngest Irish person to summit Mount Everest. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing good, thanks, Orla. Now, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. But I suppose just to start it off, what did it feel like standing on top of Everest?
Yeah, it was absolutely mad. It was, look, we had a lot of things that went wrong for us over there. So there was points where you didn't think you were actually going to stand up there. So to be able to get up there was unreal. But look, once you're up there, you have to come back down. But it was deadly. It was deadly. Can't explain the feeling.
Unbelievable. No, I couldn't do what you do now. And we're the same age. We're both 22. But the difference between you and me is you're from Waterford. And is it a small village in Waterford, or how is it like there?
Yeah, so from a small fishing village. So, quite opposite to the highest mountain in the world anyways. Yeah, I'm from sea level. So, it's lovely down here. Look, a lot of my training was done near the mountains and stuff like that. But yeah, from a small fishing village.
So actually, to do a training now, how long did you train for before Everest?
So I probably decided three or four years before that I wanted to do it. And then since then, it was full-time training. So going abroad when I could, doing loads of training at home, but full-time probably 2 years, just grinding out for the 2 years to get there. But look, I'm glad I did it. Once I went over there, I realised, thank God I did that, because if I went over and didn't have enough training done, oh my God, it would have been worse in some parts. But
definitely. So essentially, you were about 18 when you started training.
Yeah, I would have been. So, you know, I cycled around the country, and I wanted to add in something else. So I hiked the highest county, the highest mountain each county I went through. So I did that. It took me way longer. For the first mountain, I didn't even bring a jacket. I was completely underprepared. And then it kind of stemmed from there. So I went over then to do the three-piece challenge in the UK, which is the highest mountain in England, Scotland, Wales. And then to go over and do the highest mountain in South America, Aconcagua. So I became the youngest person to do that, I think it around 19. And then I decided, right, you know what, we'll give this Everest thing a go. So I put it out on my social media, and thankfully a person called Jason Black, who's done K2 and Everest before, kind of reached out to me and said, look, I've got this expedition going in 2 years. And yeah, it kind of went from there. So I went and did a mountain with him over in the Himalayas, and then went back and we cracked it out.
That's unbelievable. Oh my God, fair play to you. But like, was the reality different from what you expected?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we went over and really, I kind of trained to be able to eat at altitude and stuff like that. It'd been one thing that had been a big problem for me before. And then kind of going over, we were over there for 55 days, probably planned on being over there for nearly 3 weeks less. Just once we went over, the icefall didn't open. So that's just the first part to get to camp one. So that didn't open until probably 3 weeks later. So we went in with the expectation to get the early window, because obviously there's crowds over there. So we said, right, we'll go in with the early window. And then that didn't open. So we were over there for so long, and I couldn't eat much over there. So just, you kind of feel terrible the whole time. It's hilarious. But look, once you come back home, you kind of realize, geez, I wouldn't mind being back in a situation like that, just testing your body. But look, it was the first whole Irish team in over 20 years, and it was unbelievable with the lads. So I was great. But yeah, definitely a lot tougher than I would have thought.
Did your team, like, do you think now, would you be able to do it like by yourself the next time? Or like, did your team really make the difference in like motivating you on getting to the top?
Yeah, so in particular on summit night, we had to turn back this. So we went for the 19th of May, and then we had to turn back after 8 hours. The place, it should have taken us about 4 hours to get to this spot, but every time you took a step, you probably went 3/4 of a step back. So we had to turn around then after 8 hours, go back to our tent. We're in the dead zone at this point, and then next thing we're like, right, we might not be able to go. And then we heard that we could get a second chance. So about 6 hours later, we had to get out of the tent in the dead zone, which was awful. So I reckon from then on, like that second push, we kind of said, right, you know what, we're going to give this a go, and if we can't do it, we can't do it. But yeah, definitely the team really helped on that second push, like just kind of looking at the lads and saying, right, let's work this out together and stuff, and just pushing each other. Like I reckon we were all kind of saying that none of us probably would have made it up if we were by ourselves on this particular occasion. So it was huge having them. And look, there was a lot of pride as well. We had the tricolour in the bag and stuff like that. So it was important as well for us to try and get up there and do something that hopefully will inspire others.
No, definitely. Sure, the whole country was following you. I remember seeing it on everyone's story that they wanted updates about you. Everyone was very concerned and everything.
I know, it was mad now. It was mad because you kind of, the support was absolutely unbelievable. Just then you'll get the nicest text message if you have a down day, because of course there's days where you're waiting and you don't feel good, and then you get a really, really nice text message from someone that spurs you on. It makes you realise why you want to go and do this.
Yes, definitely. And I have to ask one question. How did your parents and your family feel about you doing this?
I told them about it. They were all so supportive, but such a stressful expedition. When I'm over there, I kind of know what's happening, so I can change things within reason. But they're back there sitting at home, and they have no clue what's going on, so they're really stressful. I think the whole house didn't sleep for about 2 or 3 weeks when we were over there. But look, it was great when I got back. Look, kind of see them. Yeah, look, they were unbelievable. Without them, it wouldn't be possible. Just kind of saying to them, they were like, right, let's make this happen. Because it's a lot of money and stuff like that. And it's very daunting thing at the start, because you realise, right, I'm going to have to raise a lot of money. I'm going to put all my savings into this. And then once you have your family kind of back and say, yeah, let's try and make this work.
Definitely. But like, not many people can say like that they climbed Mount Everest, and now you're one of them. But like, how did the altitude like affect you? Like, did it affect your way of like thinking?
Yeah, so we had little methods over there. So essentially, just on summer night, you're kind of thinking, right, I don't want to lose my judgment. So you're singing any song you can, and then you're kind of doing math sums. And now by math sums, I mean like 2 + 2 = 4 kind of stuff like that. But yeah, you're making sure that you're okay. You're really tired, and like that, your judgment wouldn't be as good as it should have been. But look, we trained a lot on high altitude mountains, so we kind of know what to expect. But like that, we were lucky. Everyone kind of, well, everyone stayed relatively healthy, and no kind of brain function. Look, I lost oxygen at one point coming down. Sitting down, you're absolutely wrecked, and you're thinking, oh, how am I going to do this? But yeah, look, everything kind of went relatively okay over there.
Did you ever consider like turning back when you were climbing the mountain?
Yeah, every second. You're looking on your way up, there's so many falls, so much you're thinking there has to be someone, but you can always see something in the background. And of course, as you know, it's the highest mountain in the world. You're like, right, well, that has to be the height of it. But yeah, look, every second you're battling with yourself, telling yourself to go down and stuff like this. But just all you can do is keep taking one step as long as you're able to. There's points where I'm sure some people look, and I've had to do it on mountains in the past, where you have to turn around for your own good. But we were feeling relatively strong, and look, we were ahead of people, which was nice. So we had a good push behind us. But yeah, it was a busy old turnaround coming down. Once you get to the summit, you're kind of buzzing with yourself, but then you realise, right, I have to get down nice and safe here. And that was actually the most amount of ever summits in a day ever. So as you can imagine, coming down was fairly sketchy, but it was good now.
So like in the whole like time of life, I guess, it's like the most people were there that day, you're saying?
Yeah. So I think there was 270 summits that day. Yes, it was most summits ever on ever. So we had planned to go the day before, but the weather was a little worse. And then we didn't get up on that day. I think there's only probably about 15 people that did get up that day. But yeah, so then the next day it was huge crowds. But yeah, so we decided to summit in the dark. So we left at about 3:30 p.m. and it took us, I think we got up there at around 3 a.m. in the morning. So it was pitch black up there, which was kind of weird because, of course, you expect these beautiful views. But then like that, you're probably no more than 2 hours on your way down, which wasn't very far because of these queues you're trying to get past. And the most unbelievable sunrise you'll ever see in your life. You can see the circumference of the world. It was an image I'll never forget. It was unbelievable.
That's class. You summited in the dark. That must have been terrifying.
Well, look, you don't see the big drops, at least, because there's a... Particularly up near the top, there's kind of a very, very tight spot where if there's two people going past each other, it's very like you're kind of going around them, and there's a 2 kilometer drop down to your right, and you're kind of hooked in. So it was kind of nice not to see that long drop. But then again, yeah, it would have been nice to see the rest of it. But yeah, look, you're so tired as well, you almost forget about the dangers up there.
Oh, fair enough. But like, lastly, what luxury item did you miss most on the climb?
Honestly, it had to be a toilet in base camp. It was just a bucket in the floor. So for 2 months, you're going into a bucket. So coming home and getting that toilet was absolutely lovely. I know it doesn't sound like the most luxury item in the world, but definitely that was it.
No, that's actually very fair. In particular, was there like, what like did you eat when you went up there? Was it just like canned food or what?
So we had expedition packets and then we didn't really eat them, to be honest. They weren't the nice things, and your body just essentially shuts down from eating food. So having it was horrible. So what kind of got us through the 5 days was noodles every now and then, probably one thing of spicy noodles a day. But yeah, a lot less food than you expect because you're burning so much calories up there, but it's just almost impossible to take anything in.
Yeah, that's very fair. But oh my God, what an experience for you. And you're going to be talking about this your whole life, I'd say.
I know, it hasn't really sunk in yet. It was less than a month ago now, and I'm still trying to process what happened. People are kind of come up and going, geez, you must be buzzing with yourself. And I'm kind of like, I haven't really sat back and thought about it. So I don't know if I ever will, but yeah, it was such a good experience and probably one that I'll go back and do again, I'd say.
You're going to go back and do it again, so do you think you're going to summit it in the daylight this time?
Hopefully. Yeah, I'd like to go from the other side. So I reckon I said, Ash, look, I've done the night now, I'll have to do the day. But yeah, that's the plan.
Jeez, usually you just go and you never like want to do it again. But fair play, great determination.
Oh, jeez, when I was over there as well, I was like, right, I'm never coming back and doing this again. And now I'm already thinking about doing it again.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks so much, Adam, for coming on to the Big Red Bench today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
The Big Red Bench. Cork. Red FM.
You're very welcome. Welcome back from the break today. You're listening to The Big Red Bench, myself, Orla O'Leary. And now we're going to move on to a bit of rugby. So Rory spoke to Munster greats Alan Quinlan and Fiona Hayes about the end of Munster's season and where the province go from here on this week's episode of The Red 78 on Off The Ball.
I'm going to get you, both your opinions on the game, Alan Quinlan. Let's start with yourself. Like, the Bulls just inside were bigger, more clinical, faster, more physical. This is a bit of a reality check for Munster, I think, was it?
Yeah, look, it wasn't a surprise, Rory. And look, the comments are, I think we when we started this podcast, first and foremost, it was to try and engage with supporters and try and give them a voice as well of their opinions. We've tried our best to read them out. Some of them are fairly damning that I've seen. Fiona hasn't read them all out, and we respect them all, but there's a frustration there. I think there's a frustration of and a lot of what's coming up is probably where the club is run behind the scenes. I go back to what I said about reviews in 2016, where it kind of opened a can of worms when I was outspoken about that. And it does feel like, even though, you know, we know there's an internal review going on, we don't know when that'll be out, but it is time for a reset and a look at all positions behind the scenes, try and get structurally, get some transparency, get some trust within the organisation again with the fans, but trust for the staff as well, because I'm sure Clayton McMillan, he hasn't a clue what's hitting this year with everything that's gone on. The systems, the way it's run, all that kind of stuff. And who does he trust? Who does he not trust? Where all this stuff is broken down. Finances are an issue, of course. I've probably said over the years that, you know, Munster, the three overseas signings, they need to go and sign three world-class players. It's not as easy as that. But you have to have the ambition to try and find a way to bring in outside money. I know lots of people who would like to help out, in a sense of, we had a situation years ago with Damien D'Allende and RG Snyman, where there was outside money came in to top up their contracts, that you could get two World Cup winners. It feels like it just needs a little injection like that, where you bring in, you know, Marius van der Merwe is the only overseas signing at the moment. I know Alex Nankivell is overseas. Next year, maybe the end of next year, he becomes Irish qualified. So there's one position available. There's talks that it's in the Tighthead area that they want to bring somebody in. Will they get a little bit of leeway to get a fourth? Again, these laws or rules are not set in stone. But I do think, like, and look, Connacht and Ulster will argue that their point that they need help and support as well. Munster needs, aside from this review, they need the IRFU to have a close look at this whole setup as well, and David Humphreys to look and see what's needed, what's required here. Structurally making it better. And again, look, you know, the idea of the four provinces from the IRFU's point of view is that they become self-sufficient, that they start generating their own funds, that there's not an over-reliance on the union every time to bail people out. All squads are being cut a little bit. There is a tightening of the belt around finances. So it's not easy, but it does need a real structural review from top to bottom, and just try and find out where this all kind of went wrong, and where, like, aside from the Roger Randall stuff for the redundancies, which is weighed heavily on the province, I think the inconsistency around the performance and some of the comments are, yes, what has Clayton McMillan brought? Where's the identity? It's difficult. And I think he's come into a group last summer not really knowing any of the individuals, trying to chop and change and get to know people. And it's been difficult. I think if he'd his time back, maybe he would have, you know, not met as many changes. Some of them were through injury, some of them were through necessity to try and keep players fresh. So it's difficult. But the quality and depth of the squad is not good enough. There is some very good players in there, and I'm not saying, oh, cast people away or anything. I mean, it just needs, they need some top class players to come in if they can and drive the standards. I just look at Jordan Henderson, who's you know, in English soccer World Cup squad. A lot of people questioning his selection. A lot of people saying he's 35. He doesn't start every week for Brentford, so it shouldn't make sense that he's in an England squad. But I've read loads of stuff, in a sense, and this isn't a Liverpool bias thing or anything. I've read loads of stuff that he's a standard driver as regards training, attitude, commitment, desire, all that. That kind of stuff. And I know people who probably haven't played sport, or maybe, I don't mean disrespectfully, at a high level, having a couple of guys in there who may not be starters, but are driving in standards. Keith Earls, Peter O'Mahony, Murray, Conor Murray, you know, these guys, and they helped drive that standard in 23 when they won it. It's, again, it's not something you can just get a magic wand and do that, but the group looks like it's lacking leaders and personality, and all the small things that they get better at that next year will help them improve as a team and become more resilient and robust and more consistent. Like, the players have got to take a lot of this in the chins themselves, because they were very, very inconsistent. And throughout the whole season, we're talking about a lot about, you know, and to quote Clayton McMillan, we get punched in the face and get a bloody nose and then we react the week after. But then it drops again. So, there's, you know, of course, and I'm not absolving coaches here, the coaches have to take responsibility as well. But you just feel it needs a couple of Jordan Hendersons in there. Ty Burn is away a lot, you know, with the internationals. Craig Casey fits that bill. He's away with the internationals. You just need, people need to step up, grow up, and have a real maturity. And look, I may be wrong, but I think, and that may seem very innocuous, but it definitely helps. And the evidence of, if anyone who comes back to me wants to say, and I don't mean disrespectfully to anyone, the performances, bar the first five games, they've been so inconsistent.
Yeah.
And I mean, those first five games, you could have, Cardiff 23-20 in round two. That Cardiff could have won that game. I did the commentary for it. Edinburgh 2019 in Cork. Edinburgh could have easily won that game. Round four was a... That was the one that gives so much enthusiasm against Leinster and Croker. Okay, the bigger picture is you win the game. But the fight was just at a really high level. They were so intense around the breakdown, their line speed, their body language, a little bit of niggle within them. It dropped off then, which is a little bit understandable against Connacht at home the week after. They won 17-15. It was unconvincing. Connacht caused them some problems. But, like, it was a great start, and you take that, but it did paper over some cracks and issues. And it was kind of like Liverpool playing. They win their first five league games, and they totally... The reality and the truth came out around their inconsistencies. So Munster's inconsistencies have been a problem, and the players have got to take that on board. And to be fair, the uncertainty around Clayton McMillan a few weeks ago, whether he's staying or going, and I'm sure he was very frustrated with the Roger Randall thing and the whole way thing had played out and all that stuff. But I feel he just needs an opportunity to draw a line in the sand this year, sit down with his own coaches and his own group and try and, you know, develop a structure and a standard around the player playing a squad, and bring in some young players, try and upskill them and get them involved. And the only way you do that is by playing matches and just get a bit of enthusiasm and vigour back in the group, because there is some very good players there. There's no doubt about that. I think when you go down into the depth, it becomes, and like most teams, if you lose 8, 10, 12 players for a quarter final of a URC, most squads would be struggling very much so. So that's the mitigation at the weekend, but the overall inconsistency hasn't been there, and the fans know it. And I think I've always said this, and I'm consistent saying this, if you have fight, spirit, passion, commitment, desire in your performances, the Munster fans will clap and applaud that. There's no one under any sort of false illusions. I saw one message coming through: would it be better next year in Europe to actually go out and play young players in the four pool games and kind of forfeit it, in the sense of we're not going to win that competition anyway, and give them opportunities to expose them to European rugby? And The answer is no, because you can't do that in Europe, and we've too much DNA involved in the competition. Mm-hmm. But there is a case of throwing caution to the wind a little bit next season in the URC, and just trying to bring some true young, bring through some young players. And then the guys who get shifted to the side who don't start, it's up to them then to raise their standards to that Jordan Henderson type drive, desire. And the Munster fans will applaud that, because there's no expectation out there that, oh, Munster are going to win a URC and a European Cup, because we're further away from that than we've probably ever been. But that can be turned fairly quickly with positivity and momentum moving forward. So that's, you know, the Munster fans, they feel it, and it affects everyone. And it's very difficult then for staff and people, because aside from the financial pressures and the redundancies that were requested, you know, if you go on kind of struggling and the crowds come down a little bit, it'll start to affect the club more and more and more and more and more people. So it's difficult, and there is a lot of responsibility when you put on a Munster jersey. But the one thing I will say is, and I give credit to the players and the coaches in the last couple of weeks, obviously it's a difficult loss to go out, but they have shown plenty of fight. Mm. And I want to see that. And we can start delving into quality and trying to improve the team in little parts then. They have shown it, but it hasn't been consistent enough this year, and they've got to take this on the chin. Looking at back at the Bulls game, the power and the strength that they have, they scored 6 tries, Munster scored 2 tries. It was sporadic bursts, really. The first 10-15 minutes was like, oh my God, this is the worst possible start. And they very nearly blew Munster away. I think there was 2 tries disallowed. It was 14-0. Munster's reaction was brilliant. They got it back to 17-14, right from the kickoff. Alex Nankivell, who had a really good game, to be fair. But I'm not sure he should be catching a kickoff like that in the position he's in. I think Brian Gleeson, your number 8, has to be catching that, or one of your back rows, or your right winger coming onto it a little bit. He was in a standing position, gets tackled. Cameron Hanicum, who had a great game, gets a turnover penalty, kick to the corner, try. That's right from the... You know, some basic errors as well were frustrating. The defence was all over the shop at times. They were very narrow, and the Bulls changed tact from the game in March. They tried to punch around it very tight to the rucks, with wingers picking and going and different backs coming in trying to pick and go, and then spreading the ball wide. They had 21 clean breaks in the game. Munster at 6. That's way too many. The kicks retained. 7 kicks retained by the Bulls. Munster 1. And that was another significant part of that first half and the damage that was done. Shane Daly's kicked the touch for the second try. It was kicked straight to Billy LaRue, and they counter-attacked, and Curtly Aronson scores. That's got to be put in the stand. So when I talk about standards in the first piece I'm talking about, it's all those simple things that they need to understand better about managing tempo when you're away from home, holding on to the ball. Niall Scannell, early on in the game, gathered a ball when the Bulls made a break up the far side of the field, set it up, Michael Alalatoa, forward pass, scrum, trouble again straight away. You know, small things, players slipping off tackles. So, yeah, look, it's they certainly tried, and the 38 missed tackles in the game, they were under immense pressure, and it could have got really, really ugly. Uglier, it was ugly, obviously, in that second half, because it was kind of all over the shop in the last 20 minutes, wasn't it? And yeah, so look, they're very powerful, and they're so strong. And the scrum, of course, you know, Munster held their own and a couple of their own balls, which was admirable, but got blown away too many times, and it was 5 scrum penalties in the game. Again, no scrum, no win. So a lot of stuff going on there, and just in the game itself, it was always going to be very difficult. You're missing so many players, and I just think it was too tall an order for Munster. I was kind of optimistic, and Fiona said the same last week, that they could have found something and made it tricky for the Bulls, but on the balance of it, you know, the Bulls just blew them away, and it was not a major surprise.
Fiona, give us your take, not just on the game, but I suppose how it, I suppose, blends into Munster's season and the campaign that they've had.
Look, I have to agree. I thought they, you know, they were outpowered in that game, outblasted off. But I thought the offloading game from the Bulls, we said it as well. You expected it more in the wider channels, but as Quinny said, they were breaking through that internal contact, getting the offload away, and Munster were missing tackles left, right, and centre. But I have to say, the fight in them to go a couple of tries down, penalty, to be able to, I suppose, come back, get themselves into the game. Obviously, I felt they couldn't last the 80 minutes. The bench probably as well that came on. There wasn't much of an impact, and you look at that Bulls bench that came on. They were just, you know, you were talking about Hanekim. I mean, he was taken off. He was probably game on to be player of the game. He was taken off at 55 minutes, and their back row were still outstanding. They just had the ability to get guys on and bring that pace, bring that tempo. Munster also looked tired. I mean, it's not easy playing in that type of heat or you know, the air, humidity, everything. Like it's hard. So they did. So for me, I think the season finished. Probably I didn't expect it to be such a big loss, but it just sums up how the season went. 5 scrum offences is just not good enough. We've been saying it. Look, and they've been unlucky. You know, Jaeger, I mean, when he came in, everyone was like, yes, he does have the talent at scrum time. Salanoa as well, big guy, expected a lot. And obviously, through injury, really unlucky with both players. But it's just not good enough, to be honest. And that's what really frustrates me, is scrum time, how, you know, they just don't have the players, but also they're getting blown away by the South Africans. And look, it's easy to say, yes, they're quite powerful, but I have to say, throughout the whole season, that was one area that really disappointed me. Just didn't seem to have the connections. They were all over the place at times. And Quinny's right, there was a couple of good ones where the sustained pressure, but if you're able to do that, you should be able to consistently do that with your connections. So throughout the season, I suppose what you're saying, Rory, that would have been an area that was huge frustration for me, because it was so inconsistent. I mean, one game they could be really good, and the next day it could be absolute shambles, and that shouldn't change. You know, obviously power game will come true towards the end of the game, but this is from the start when they were playing South African teams. But look, you can't fault their fight to get that into that top 8. That was absolutely huge for them, and that was probably a pivotal moment in the season where you almost felt a relief in the players. They were outbeaten over in South Africa in all areas of the game. And I have to say, as Quinny said, I thought Nankerville in the centre throughout the season, he's someone that's offered a little bit of spark. We haven't seen enough of that spark in that back line, but certainly he's brought it a lot of occasions when he's been really, really good. Just his tackling, his offloading game, his ability to beat defenders is good to watch. But it's been a really, really frustrating season for me. And look, having been involved in the women's game, Rory, there's been a lot of reviews in the past that where they say we're reviewing it, and we all know there's people inside that review who haven't an absolute rashers or even associated with the women's game sometimes on the ground. And it is frustration. Eventually things came true and eventually we got there, but I think with Munster, if they're saying this, they have to review it properly. It's not just a sweep under the carpet thing. There's a lot going on. As I said, unlucky with injuries and different parts, and obviously the two, Byrne and Crowley, missing that last game has been huge, and there's been a couple of European games where they've missed as well. But certainly I think from a Munster fan perspective, it hasn't been good enough, and all that outside noise then just adds to the frustration around that. And there needs to be something fresh, something new in there. And if Macmillan is staying, he needs to bring in some of his own guys. We need to see something different. We need to see an identity of how they're playing, and just, you know, something added to this team. Because I think a lot of the teams in Ireland are playing the same style of rugby, same type of rugby, same, I suppose, formations. Let's get something different in there. Let's make Munster as powerful, even if it's Maul. Those days are gone when we were just a powerhouse in the lineout. Bring back that and try and get something different into this Munster team. And I know it'll take time, but there's certainly some young guns coming through, and they just need what Quinny said, that leadership, those people in there pushing them on to be the greatest they can be.
You're listening to The Big Red Bench with myself, Orla O'Leary. And now we're going to move on to a bit of boxing. So Cork professional boxer Stephen Cairns is speaking after the launch press conference for the Pearse O'Leary versus Mark Chamberlain fight in the Tree Arena on August 1st. And he is speaking to Off the Ball's Matthew Brennan.
Right, Stephen Cairns, you've trekked all the way up from Cork this morning up to the Gibson ahead of a big fight card on the 1st of August. I imagine you're looking forward to being part of that one.
Yeah, can't wait to get back in the Tree Arena. Second show within 6 months. It's unbelievable. It's a privilege to be able to fight in Dublin again, fight in Ireland. It's been a long time coming for Irish fighters. We've always had to go on the road, whether it's the UK or America, and being able to come home, it's a privilege, and I'm honoured to be here.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the second show in a couple of months, the last time we saw you fighting on the undercard of the Anto Kakachi and Jazza Dickens, so Pearse O'Leary was essentially main event in it himself as well. You brought a serious crowd up from Cork that night. I remember you weren't, I wouldn't say early on the card, but you weren't towards the end of the card, but the noise in the arena sort of set the tone for what was to come.
Yeah, that's
I got the
crowd going, yeah, with that before the main card kicked off. Obviously it was an unbelievable card. There was a 3 world title fights on it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Unbelievable cards. I got my supporters from Cork come up, nearly, was it 500-600 of them come up, and you could hear them in there, as you said, unbelievable. And they support me always, whether it's over in the UK, whether it's up in Dublin now, which is easier for people. Yeah, it's great to have that type of support backing me. And eventually we will get back down to Cork and we'll give them a home day instead of having to travel.
That's what I was going to say. We'll come back to the kind of having to go abroad and all that sort of stuff too, but I don't know if you remember, but I spoke to you briefly after your win the last day, and you were talking about the idea of getting a card down to the marquee, and it obviously isn't happening right now, but for you, I imagine that's something that's right up the top of a bucket list maybe that you have for what you want to do before your career is out, which of course is a long way down the line at the moment.
Yeah, so now we're planning on by next summer doing the marquee, booking in for the marquee next summer, doing the show down in Cork. There's plenty of Cork boxes there to get on it. Pack it out, maybe I think it's 4,000 or 5,000 people, and hopefully get like a European title on it. Yeah. Fight for a European title in Cork. That would be a dream.
Absolutely. And if the Cork hurlers are anything to go by, I mean, I'm sure that place will be covered in red by the time next summer rolls around.
100%, we get everybody wearing the jerseys.
Yeah, that'd be certainly something, yeah, for sure. You mentioned there obviously about having to go abroad, and it's been a long time coming for Irish boxers to be able to get these opportunities. And these opportunities are to be fighting in Dublin and be fighting in Ireland. They seem to be coming around a little bit more often now. Now, we won't count our chickens. We've seen, you know, promising times before, and then it not really come to fruition. But it seems as though the momentum is moving in the right direction, and there's a lot of positivity around Irish boxing at the minute for one reason or another. I was talking to Bobby Flood a couple of minutes ago and asking him the same kind of thing. It's something I'm seeing from the outside looking in, I suppose. Is it something you're feeling as a boxer, that the tide is kind of moving in the right direction for Irish boxing?
Yeah, it's for us fighters now, Irish fighters now, it's unbelievable, because you had the last generation, they all had to travel. They had no fights no fights in Ireland. So for us right now, it's a great time for being an Irish fighter. And what you've seen, the last show done, 10,000 people packed out, one of the best atmospheres I've heard in boxing.
Yeah.
I've been to a lot of shows, and I was one of the unbelievable atmospheres.
And it wasn't just Irish people saying that as well.
It was everybody
as well. We're thinking, Jesus, we travel around the world for this stuff, and this is right up there. You know?
And that's why they came back within 6 months later. Exactly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's because the Irish fans are the best fans in the world, and they get behind their own, they back their own. And if we keep getting the fans to the show, keep packing out these arenas, they're going to keep coming back and giving every. It's because it's not just about us fighters now. This is the younger generation that are coming through. We're giving them the opportunities. We're setting the tone that Ireland is the place to be for Irish boxing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, back to you personally then, your last your last fight was very impressive, a very impressive victory. You kind of had all the elements of what you want to see, I suppose. From the outside looking in, you might disagree, you might agree. It was calculated, but it was also vicious in a good way, in that you chased a knockout when the time was right without leaving yourself vulnerable to maybe catching one on the way in. I don't know if your summary would be the same as that, but I imagine you were fairly happy and content with how that fight went.
Yeah, I was very happy with my first 10 round fight.
Yeah.
And for fighters, it's a big thing, do you know what I mean? Because you learn a lot about yourself in a championship fight. And to be able to go in there, I stuck to my game plan, listened to my coach. We went in there, we broke him down with the jab, got my distance right, body shots, warmed down. And then in the 9th round, I had that acceleration button to be able to go in there and get the knockout and put the pressure on. And as you see, we had three knockdowns in the last round, made him crumble. And yeah, it was a great performance. But I still went away. I still analysed my performance, looking at things that I could have done better.
Yeah,
things that I should have done maybe before the 9th round to probably get the knockout faster. Because I'm never 100% happy with my performances. I always want better, because we're fighters, we have to strive for perfection.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the great mentality to have. But it must fill you and your team, I suppose, with a lot of confidence, knowing that when you got to that stage in the 9th round, you weren't in any way, shape or form wilting. You had loads in the tank and you were able to press that button, as you said. That must be a very kind of nice thing for yourself and your team to be able to take away from the fight, I suppose, even maybe more so than the win itself.
Yeah, so going forward now, we know that's another box ticked. I put in a lot of hard work. I train all the time. I train twice a day, 6 days a week. I put in a lot of work with Boxing Science, with Dave Colwell, and it just shows. That fight shown my training that I've been putting in, and that wasn't just a training camp.
Yeah.
That was 5 years of being a pro led to that moment, and all the experience I gained there, I'm just going to be a better fighter on my next fight again.
What's the kind of difference in when you're approaching a fight between the kind of theoretical mental sort of side of what you're going to have to be facing your opponent and how you're going to go and get going and on and win the fight, versus the physical preparation of, you know, making the weight, getting the reps in, making sure you've got that button to press in the 9th round? How do you weigh that up, and kind of how does your approach go, without giving away too much, I suppose, for whoever you're going to be fighting on the 1st of August?
Yeah, so you just in training camp, you push yourself so hard in training camp, and you tick so many boxes. Like, you do all the sparring you've done, all the runs you've done, strength work, pad work, bag work, it all adds up. And by the end of your training camp, when you're having your last spar camp, you can just feel it all coming together. And you just feel unbelievable. You feel like you're ready to go, like you've got the energy bubbling in you. And then the hardest part of boxing is probably the 12 weeks of dieting. Is making sure, getting down to the weight, being very disciplined with what you eat. I don't find it as hard now because I'm doing it so often.
Yeah.
But at the start of your career, it's a big thing. And now I'm a fighter that has ticked a lot of boxes.
Yeah.
My diet's on point, my training's on point.
Yeah.
And I've gained that experience now. So
you mentioned there about all that work that does go in, the work you do before, and then you're one of the kind of better fighters I find that documenting that sort of stuff for people to see on your Instagram or TikTok across socials and all that sort of stuff. What's the kind of logic behind doing all that sort of thing? We know, like, as boxers, when you sign with a promotion, that obviously helps with getting your name and your profile, but it's equally as important to create your own brand. Is probably a horrible word, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, what's your reason behind doing that? You probably enjoy it too.
As a fighter, you are a brand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're building a brand, so people know who you are.
Yeah.
People want to come watch you fight. They want to tune in on a pay-per-view, or they want to come buy a ticket and come down and watch. So it's important to build that brand, but you can build that brand while helping other people.
Yeah.
So that's what I do on my page. I show people how I live, I show people what I eat, I show people discipline, I show people everything that it takes to be a professional fighter.
Yeah.
And people enjoy it. People like seeing the behind the scenes, because people see the fight nights, they see the 30 minutes, but they don't see the 12 weeks of training camp every day. So that's why I like to document, to show the people, and I feel like people enjoy it, and I enjoy showing people.
Now that's all we have time for today on the Big Red Bench with myself, Orla O'Leary. But What a weekend of sports it was. So we had the Ireland women's who were playing on a Friday night in a very vital match for the chase to the World Cup 2027, where they won 3-2 against the Netherlands. And now all our eyes are on Tuesday, because if we win on Tuesday, that's us straight into the World Cup going to Brazil next year, which I am contemplating. I think I will go myself if they get there, but I've no doubt they will because there's playoffs as well. And then early Saturday morning, Ireland men's drew 1-1 with Canada. We're beating all these World Cup teams. It's a shame, isn't it? And then the Rebels just losing out on 1 point today against Limerick for the Munster final. But that was the Big Red Bench today. You can listen to us again next weekend from 6 to 7 p.m. Up next, we have Mags Blackburn with Green on Red.
The Big Red Bench. Big Red Bench.